June calendar, our next to the last day. 97, 0574, 0575, 0576, 0577, 0735, 1101, and 1102, Community Credit Plan versus Johnson McKay, Nader, Schulte, Quattlebaum. We have a 25-minute schedule for Arthur M. Maglowski.
Morning, Jay. My name is Arthur M. Maglowski. Joined here with my co-counsel, Penny Gentris.
We are a counsel for the petitioner and Community Credit Plan. We're with a law firm of Bassett Maglowski in Milwaukee. This is a consolidated appeal from the decision of the Court of Appeals District 1. The court, Judge Wiedemeyer and Judge Schutzen, reversed and remanded the final order of the trial court, the Honorable Michael Malmstead, in Small Claims Court in Milwaukee County, from a case involving the fee-shifting statute under the Wisconsin Consumer Act, which is 425-308. Judge Curley filed a dissenting opinion in the Court of Appeals decision. The trial judge had held that the fee-shifting provisions of the Consumer Act was inapplicable to the procedural motions to vacate McLevin judgments which had been brought by the customers, and the court then denied any attorney's fees under the fee-shifting statute, stating that the statute simply did not apply. Community Credit at the trial court level had moved for a voluntary dismissal, and the court did grant to the customers, to the people, attorney's fees, or costs at least, under that statute in the amount of $250 each. The Court of Appeals, in reversing the trial court decision, said that the customers had prevailed in the litigation. They had met the significant benefits requirement that had been pronounced by the courts, and that the creditor had violated the Wisconsin Consumer Act venue statute, which is 421-401, by, and we use the word in quotes, prosecuting the McLevin actions in Milwaukee County, which was not the proper place of trial.
No, why do you think that they brought these in Milwaukee County when they... pretty clear that there were a number of them, there were five or six, seven, and when it was clearly a transaction that did not take place. What was the advantage to Community Credit?
Frankly, Judge, none. I think it was a result of a new employee who was relatively inexperienced. She had been trained in Milwaukee County by her predecessor. Actually, her offices were in Waukesha, and it would have been made more sense for her to bring the actions in Waukesha because her offices were just a short distance from the courthouse.
But there's an implication, at least in the decision, that it's an advantage, that they were taking advantage of the customer. And I wanted to know what that advantage would be.
Frankly, Your Honor, I think it's a disadvantage, but the court found otherwise. Again, I think the court's decision was somewhat speculative on that, and it doesn't appear of record, of course, other than the fact that there are affidavits that indicate that this was not an attorney. She was a young lady doing her job, and as it is in small claims court, a lot of these cases are prosecuted by non-lawyers. And I don't see any advantage. In fact, she had to travel an extra 30-some miles to go to Milwaukee.
Do you do business all over the state? Does your client...
Does our law
your
firm?
Client. No, your client.
Community Credit? frankly, Your Honor, I'm not sure. I know that their offices are in the Milwaukee and Waukesha area, but I'm not sure if they make loans outside of those counties. I know that one of the cases is from Walworth County. The Schulte case is from Dodge County. So there is certainly a metropolitan area that they deal with, but just how far upstate they go, I'm not sure. I don't have an answer. I'm sorry.
Well, the Wisconsin Consumer Act itself, which was passed back, I believe, in the early 70s, it applies, is it a specific, it seems to me that if you knowingly misuse the venue statute, that's one thing. In this case, that could be argued that there was a knowing misuse of venue. That's why I asked you the question.
Well, we have two cases this morning, Your Honor, and in the first case, the fee-shifting case, none of that is of record. I can only tell you that this young lady brought these cases in Milwaukee County for reasons which I can only attribute to the fact that she had told me that's where she was trained. Now, again, that's not of the record, and I apologize for speaking out of the record, but to answer your question, that was the only reason I know why they were brought in Milwaukee County. As far as whether or not someone knowingly violates the venue statute, for example, I imagine at some level, certain conduct that would otherwise be acceptable is unacceptable. However, there is nothing in the record which would indicate that to be the case in the cases that are now before this court. And I certainly acknowledge, and there is a section, by the way, Your Honor, that might cover that, and that would be the unconscionable conduct section, which, again, is not before the court in either of these two cases.
That was Riverside, the Riverside case.
Yes. In any event,
one quick question. I take it that you do not contest that none of the venue statutes were followed. That the venue statute was not followed. That's not an issue at all before.
Well,
or is it?
In some respects, it is, because you have to understand the venue statute. If you look at 421-401, it's a fluid statute. When you start the action, basically, the statute allows the creditor to start the action in any of the 72 counties, because you file your action, and then if you can serve the defendant in that county, it's a proper place of trial.
Personally, sir.
If you can locate the collateral in that county, the venue is fine.
What if the car moves in and out of a county? Is that okay then?
Well, that's a good question. Maybe the next case will address
that.
This
does not present the issue of locating.
I can only say this, Your Honor, that traditionally in Wisconsin, if you look back at the old venue statutes that have always been in existence, in replevin actions, the county where the collateral is located has always been a proper place of jurisdiction. I guess if the car is moved the day before you start the action, somebody might have a good argument that there wasn't any jurisdiction. The fourth method of attaching jurisdiction is if the contract was signed in that county. But then there's a fifth, and that's probably the most important, which points out that this is a fluid statute, and that is the statute then goes on to say 421-401 sub 2, if you have none of those elements that attach venue, if the defendant who's been served, as these were in this case, actually appear in court on the return of the summons and waive that defective venue, then Milwaukee County would have been the proper place. So you start out with a case where the summons and complaints are properly and timely served, and then you have that hiatus period between that time and the return date when venue may actually terminate.
Well, counsel, I'm thinking simply in terms of writing this case. Are we going to have to spend a lot of time discussing whether or not the venue statute was complied with, or are you conceding for purposes of this case that the venue statute was not complied with?
What we are conceding, Your Honor, is that the Judicial Court Commissioner probably did not properly review the file and the return of the summons, because it was the court that had the obligation, is the gatekeeper on the issue of venue. All of the information was not before the court on the return date. For example, no one had an affidavit where the collateral was located or where, none of that. But I would say this. As the cases before this court, venue was probably improper. The issue that the court has to address is the creditor responsible for that improper venue. That is the issue.
No, the issue you have is whether you're going to pay attorney fees under 425-308.
Well, yes, Your Honor, except that the statute says that the fee-shifting statute doesn't apply unless the creditor has been in violation of the statute. So before you decide whether or not they are entitled to attorney's fees, you have to find out whether or not they violated the statute. And the issue really is, did the creditor violate the venue statute when on the return of the summons, and it came before the small claims court in Milwaukee County, and the statute says the court shall dismiss, and the court didn't. Then the question comes up, is the creditor somehow vicariously liable to the customer because the court did not dismiss?
Well, but doesn't it always the court that has to dismiss? I mean, even if you voluntarily went to court and said, I want this case dismissed, the court has to dismiss it.
No, I understand that, Judge, but if you read 421-401, it's very clear that the legislature appointed the court as the gatekeeper. Otherwise, they could have used the word creditor.
How is the gatekeeper? It says, if the action arises out of consumer credit transaction, the court shall dismiss it in lieu of transferring it to another county.
Right.
So that's the point, but courts always dismiss. Who should pay the attorney fees? You want the court commissioner to pay him?
Well, I don't believe so because, again, you have to look at the Consumer Act, which was, first off, replevin actions under the Consumer Act were delegated to the small claims court, and I think that the legislature was well aware of the fact that most of these cases were being prosecuted by non-lawyers, and that in order to protect the customers, they didn't want to rely on the non-lawyer on an issue like venue, and basically appointed the court. The court would be the gatekeeper. And again, you have to say, the first question is, did Community Credit violate the venue statute by commencing the actions in Milwaukee County? And the answer to that, I think, is clearly no, it did not, because the statute allows the creditor to commence the action in any of the 72 counties in the state. The second question comes up then, on the return of the summons, who had the responsibility, the duty, to review the return of the summons to see whether any of the incidences of jurisdiction or venue were there.
How can the court, as you said, the court's a gatekeeper. Let's say in the Meter case, how can the court determine where the collateral was located on the return date?
Probably can't, Your Honor. But
then how can the court be the gatekeeper?
Because the statute surely says when it appears that venue does not apply. So the court could look at the pleadings and say, okay, number one, it was not served in this county. So that element did not occur. Attached to the pleading in every consumer credit transaction is the contract. So they can look at the contract and say, well, the contract was signed in Kenosha County, so that element doesn't appear. There is no evidence before the court on where the collateral is located, so we can't really deal with that issue. And the defendant didn't appear here and waive the defect. Therefore, the appearance is that it is not the proper county, and we can dismiss.
Well, I'm looking at in the Kett case, Frank Kett. The contract, at least on a quick read, doesn't appear to me to indicate where it was signed.
Judge, if you look at where the address of the creditor, isn't that on the contract? I believe it is.
Yeah, the address is, but that's not.
Yeah, well, these are.
His address is 228 North Charles, Waukesha, Wisconsin.
Yeah, but Your Honor, these are 13809 contracts, and they require them to be signed in the office. The statute requires them to be signed in the office of the creditor.
I don't. I see the reference to 13809. Is there any place on these contracts that the gatekeeper, court commissioner, could say, "Oh, this signed and sworn to before me at Waukesha, Wisconsin, this 15th day of December"? Is there any place that indicates where this contract is signed?
The indication would be the address of the creditor. However, again, the court only has to look at it and say, does it appear? That's what the statute says. Does it appear that venue is in this county? I don't think they have to make a final decision.
Under your argument, let's say all of these cars and the boat or whatever were all in Milwaukee or Antigonish. Of course, the court commissioner doesn't know that, so the court commissioner takes a look and dismisses all of these. But then you would have been proper.
Well, I think that, and again, you have to understand that We do a lot of these things, a lot of these replevins, probably several thousand a year. These questions don't normally come up.
My point is this. You argue that the court commissioner should be the gatekeeper. Yet, looking at the contract, I can't tell where it's signed. Looking at the summons and complaint, there's no reference to where the property or collateral is located. So the five things that you list as giving venue, two won't show up on the day of the return.
Okay, well, that
that's a heck of a gatekeeper.
Well, I think that leads to another question, and that is, is it proper in any case for a defendant who's properly and timely served with a summons to throw it in a garbage basket and not even call the court? I mean, there are rules. The Wisconsin Small Claims Act has a provision that you can make a telephone call. You can respond by a letter. I mean,
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I think that's the whole point about 421.401. This is not to protect the creditor. It protects the debtor. That's why it says, look, here are your five ways of getting venue. Then it says, when it appears that it's pending, that it's not that, when it appears from the term of service that the county in which it's pending is not a proper place, then it either transfers it, or if it's a consumer credit transaction, it dismisses. And it says, unless the defendant appears and waives. So it's saying, even if the defendant is in default, that defendant is protected, which is a very unusual statute for venue, right?
It is. No question about it.
So this whole thing is geared to protect the defendant.
I agree, Your Honor.
And so if the court can't determine whether that's a good claim for venue, it doesn't really make any difference because the debtor is protected. Now, you put a lot of weight on the court shall do the following. Well, look at 801.08. This is where there's objection to personal jurisdiction. If the court decides it lacks jurisdiction, the defendant shall be given the relief. I mean, I bet you can find a load of statutes where it says that the court shall do something. That doesn't shift the burden from the parties to the court.
Well, again, Your Honor, I think that if you look at it in the perspective of the small claims court, and the fact that even for the creditor, very often these questions are unanswered. The creditor, for example, who buys indirect paper from motor vehicle dealers might not have a clue as to where that contract was signed. Was it signed in the office of the dealer, or was it signed at the home of the customer? I mean, I think the problem is that on this issue of venue, it's an issue that is very difficult not only for the court, it's difficult for the creditor in many cases. And I'm only saying is that the statute seems to have some wiggle room. And the wiggle room simply is that the court, on the return of the summons, if it appears that venue is not proper, dismisses. And I think to answer all these questions, I think the answer is that if there is any question on the court could do one of two things. They could say, number one, we're going to adjourn this, and I want you to come in with an affidavit or some proof that there is actually venue here, or I'm going to dismiss.
Well, didn't you know right away? Shouldn't your client have known right away that they were in the wrong county?
She didn't know.
Yeah, well, that was my...
But as a matter of law, she's held to know. She's held to know that the venue is reside, personally served, where it's located. Doesn't the Department of Transportation know where cars are located in the sense that people say where that car is going to be located?
No. Okay. The truth of the matter is, when these cases are in default, one of the biggest problems is first finding the defendants to serve them, and then after you find them, to find the cars to repossess it. I mean, this is a difficult procedure when you get down to issues like this where, frankly, on the return of the summons, there's a lot of information that's not before you or before the creditor or before the court. And I have to come back to my statement that The statute and the legislature seemed to provide the wiggle room for the court, and that was if it appears not to be proper, the court simply dismisses.
If this court were to say that your argument is not well taken, in other words, that the gatekeeper basically is your client, that it is community credit, what? We have the damages, we have the $250 assessed by Judge Malmstead, but under the Wisconsin Consumer Act, I see $25, but then are you concerned about additional, what are your concerns there, that would it be additional attorney fees and costs in addition to what has already been assessed? I'd like to know what, if you don't prevail, what is the worst scenario as far as...
Well, in the fee-shifting case, yes. The worst scenario is we're going to have more hearings on whether the $250 per case awarded by Judge Malmstead was reasonable using the standards of the Consumer Act rather than whatever standards Judge Malmstead applied. There's no assurance that he might not come back and say, well, $250 was all you needed for a unopposed motion to vacate a default judgment in small claims. In fact, he said that. Now, I don't know. Judge Malmstead's been rotated. I assume some other judge is going to get these cases if they're returned on the issue of how much more, if any, should be given, and that's going to be some additional hearings. And I think the concern now, Your Honor, is that after the appeals and now the court of the Supreme Court matter, and then we're going to have hearings on those issues, these attorney's fees are going to be really significant. They're going to be substantial.
Well, $250, what's the going rate in Milwaukee per hour now?
I'm informed around $150 an hour.
So that's about 2 hours' work.
Or a little less, yes. And again, I'd like to point out to the court, these were unopposed motions. We did not oppose them, except in Quattlebaum, and that was a little different because it was not opposed on Wisconsin Consumer Act grounds. The Quattlebaums were in bankruptcy, and there were some bankruptcy issues that were addressed.
Well, yeah. you have awfully big problems, don't you, if this court decides to apply 425.305?
Well, yes, and that's the next case, Your Honor, and we believe that... if this court should find that, in this case, in the fee-shifting case, that the statute was violated by community credit, then we do go back to court to determine the attorney's fees in the fee-shifting case. That sort of spills over into the next case that this court will hear, and that is what are the penalties assessed to be assessed for that violation, and we have a different view than the Court of Appeals did. Yes, Your Honor.
It seems to me... You do have an argument under 421.401 in your gatekeeper, but it also seems to me that you have other arguments here about whether the customer prevailed, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Maybe you should reach that.
Okay. We will do that.
It's our fault. We don't spend a lot of time on that.
Again, we feel that the question of prevailing has not been defined by the statute, so it has been defined by the court. And the cases that have been cited are the Nicolau case, the Squires case, the Harvell case, and the DeSoto case. And all those cases address the question of whether there was significant benefits requirement. And in the Harvell case, the court said that the customer has to succeed on more than a minor issue. It has to succeed on a significant issue in litigation. In the DeSoto case, the court made it clear that attorney's fees under the fee-shifting statute would be awarded only in the event that the creditor is found to have violated any provision of the Wisconsin Consumer Act. This case is actually a case of first impression because none of the cases that have been reported to my knowledge dealt with a procedural motion as this one does. All those cases were trials where either there was a counterclaim or an affirmative defense. Here, this case is a procedural motion, which I think is something new.
In this case, counsel, what if the statute of limitations ran while this case was pending? Would your position be any different then? I know your position right now is that the dismissal here was insignificant.
Yes.
But what if the statute of limitations had run so that you couldn't file again? Would that have been, would that change it? And should it?
I don't quite follow.
What if you can't refile? If you're the...
Because statute of limitations had run against the creditor?
Yeah.
I think as far as the creditor is concerned, it might have been quite significant. However, the statute of limitations on the stuff is 6 years, and we rarely run into that.
Yeah.
I mean, I agree, Your Honor, that if the statute had run during the pendency of the fee-shifting case, of course, keep in mind, Your Honor, these cars had been repossessed and sold 9, 10, 11 months before these motions were brought, so basically these judgments were satisfied. I agree that a satisfaction had not been recorded with the court, but in a quasi in rem statute, which is 425-206, 205, in which these cases were prosecuted under, the only issue in the case is who's entitled to possession. And once the creditor got possession and sold the cars and took the money and applied it to the account, there wasn't anything further for it to do except defend a motion to vacate, which came almost 10, 11 months later.
So your position really is you have prevailed. You got a default judgment and you got the car. So you prevailed. The only problem is they're saying you prevailed on a void judgment. Well, they should prevail and get it back from you.
Well,
I mean,
that's the second case, Your Honor.
I understand that.
Yes.
That's the question as to whether who prevailed. The point is, you got everything. You really prevailed in this case. You got a judgment. You got satisfaction of the judgment. So, I mean, that's your argument here is you prevailed. They didn't prevail.
Yes, except the burden's the other way around. In order for them to get attorney's fees, they have to show that not only did we prevail, but they prevailed.
I understand that.
Yeah.
So you prevailed, but the problem you have, is whether that judgment is void. If that judgment is void, they prevailed.
Well, not necessarily, Your Honor, because in the next case you'll find that the Court of Appeals said it didn't make any difference. And the Court of Appeals in the second case said it didn't make any difference whether those judgments were vacated. A void judgment's always void, period.
Right.
It can be challenged at any time.
Right.
And therefore, if you follow that decision, which we'll argue next, basically clearly they didn't prevail. The customers didn't prevail because the Court of Appeals in the second case said it didn't make any difference. It doesn't make any difference. You could challenge that even if the judgment still had been a record. The court said it doesn't make any difference. If it's a void judgment, it's void, kaput.
So you don't think that they prevail if there's a void judgment?
In this case?
In any case.
No, not in this case. In the second case, they clearly prevail.
Okay.
But not in this case.
Thank you, counsel, and you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. I should have announced previously, but it's not too late to announce now, that Justice Steinmetz, who is not here today but is at home recovering from an operation, is here with us in spirit because he's on a telephone line and can hear the argument, and if he wishes can participate. So you may hear voices emanating from this chair, and it's not by magic. Are you there?
I'm here, and everything is very clear.
Okay. He said he's there, and everything is very clear. That means he hears your voices. It's not a statement about the arguments, counsel. All right. Counsel? Mr. Harmon? You represent the defendants here.
Good morning to the honorable members of this court, to counsel for community credit, and to the other persons present in the court. I am Gerald Harmon. I represent Marcia and Hulda Johnson, Frank Kett, Kenneth Mader, Roger Schuett, and Lily and Dorothy Quattlebaum. These people are the customers in these 7 consolidated cases. Each of these cases is before this court in denial by the circuit court of the customer's request for reasonable attorney fees and expenses under the fee-shifting provision of the Wisconsin Consumer Act. Attorney fees were sought from Community Credit to compensate each customer for having to retain an attorney to obtain dismissal of improperly venued replevin actions filed by community.
They had to have retained an attorney? I mean, they knew that they didn't live in Milwaukee. Or do you think an attorney was necessary?
Your Honor, I didn't hear.
No, you said for having to have retained an attorney. I said they could have come in there themselves, right?
Yes, Your Honor, they could have. However, without an attorney, they probably would have never known they had that right. And, Your Honor, the customers were compelled to retain an attorney and to file the motions which were filed. I don't think the customers can be expected to know the requirements of the Wisconsin Consumer Act, at least to the extent of a creditor on the other side, a merchant whose business that entails.
They have a right to be represented by counsel, don't they?
Yes, Your Honor.
They choose to represent themselves or choose to be represented by counsel, they're held to the same standards.
Correct, Your Honor.
Mr. Harmon, to what extent are your clients seeking attorney's fees? Are they asking for partial attorney's fees, or are they asking for attorney's fees in regard to all activities that counsel have engaged in?
Your Honor, the customers are seeking reasonable attorney fees under the fee-shifting provision, which whatever amount that is. Your Honor, I think it's important to understand how the attorney fee issue in these cases first arose.
Well, let me, if I might, follow this for just a minute. It's my understanding that your clients came in and asked that the default judgment be set aside in each instance. Are they asking for attorney's fees only in regard to that issue, or are they asking for attorney's fees in regard to all of the issues for which counsel has been retained?
Your Honor, they're asking for attorney fees for all of the issues. They came in with the motions seeking dismissal of the replevin actions. They obtained dismissal of each and all of these replevin actions. Now, they had to get the judgments reopened and set aside, but the ultimate objective was dismissal of the replevin actions.
Let me ask you this. This case, we've got two cases, both of you are arguing each of these cases. The attorney fees you're asking for now relate to this case, right, where you're a defendant.
Correct, Your Honor.
I assume you'll argue for attorney fees in the other case relating to where your clients are the plaintiffs. But we're right now on this case.
Correct, Your Honor.
So you want all the attorney fees relating to this case.
Correct, Your Honor.
Let me ask you another long around fees. Hypothetically, if we were to say that the merchant is the quote, gatekeeper, is strictly liable and is responsible for correct menu, if the merchant falls under the Wisconsin Consumer Act, then hypothetically, he or she or the company can start the action again and again be in the wrong, not very likely, but could again have the wrong venue, and you could have, on the same case, a violation of the Wisconsin Consumer Act. And in the same case, in other words, it could be started incorrectly once we make a venue a non-procedural, once it becomes a substantive issue falling under the Wisconsin Consumer Act. Then you could also recover for the case itself. In other words, you have the second case. I don't want to get into that, but there could be a recovery under the Wisconsin Consumer Act for that also. But in other words, you could recover if we find that the merchant must be responsible or is responsible as the gatekeeper because they should have known where to bring the action.
Your Honor, let me see if I understand the question.
In other words, it's multiple recoveries for the same, for potentially the same case.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. If the creditor does not select the proper venue twice in regards to a same customer, same transaction, then yes, Your Honor, the customer's position would be that they should be entitled to reasonable attorney fees in obtaining the dismissal of both of those actions for improper venue.
Now, that's different than any other action where under 805 or 801 there is normally cost assessed, but is it because of the type of transaction, because it is a consumer transaction, makes this different?
Yes, Your Honor. And insofar as the venue defect, it is strictly consumer credit transactions, which are special type of consumer transaction.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the answer to the question. You bring suit A in Milwaukee County, that is, the community credit brings suit A in Milwaukee County, and it's dismissed because it's the wrong venue. And you get costs under 801, which include a flat sum for attorney fees, right? I mean,
under which section, Your Honor?
Under the general costs section. Let's forget about 425, right? Okay. Then you bring another action, or CCP brings another action up in Douglas County. And that gets dismissed. You would want your costs there, too, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So if you want, if you were entitled to attorney fees under 425.308 in the first action, then you'd also want, which is dismissed, you'd also want attorney fees in the second action, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
That was dismissed. Okay.
Correct, Your Honor.
Counsel, question. I don't like to bring in the second case, but I think it does spill over into this case. So let's assume in the second case we should decide that the Court of Appeals was correct and that this was a void judgment. In the second case. Now, in this case, this was a default judgment that was rendered, correct?
Correct, Your Honor, in each case.
Why would you not pursue in this case, rather than a dismissal, just say this was void? The default judgment was void, and thereby bring into play, I think, 425.305, which allows you to keep everything.
Well, Your Honor, one simple answer, it's in the wrong venue. And the customers would be better suited to pursuing that claim in a venue that's more convenient to them.
I don't understand the answer.
But, Your Honor, and that's what these customers did. In addition to having the Milwaukee County Riplevin judgments set aside and those actions dismissed, then they went out to the different counties, the proper venues, Dodge County, Walworth County, Waukesha County, and filed their separate actions in proper venues to pursue those actions. Venues more convenient to their situation.
And then they were consolidated. They were all in the same Court of Appeals district, apparently.
The three that are here before this court, Your Honor.
Right, were consolidated.
Counsel, one of the problems I have is the argument that improper venue is a violation. How about improper venue? To me, seems to be improper venue, and not tantamount to a violation. Lurking behind the scenes of this case may be an argument that, look, with all of these cases, maybe there was a unfair and deceptive practice going on. But that's not raised in the pleadings. That's not raised in the motion. That's not part of the order. So if we're dealing with improper venue, you've got some mom-and-pop company who sold something and now is the plaintiff, and mistakenly file it where they think the collateral is located, but the information they got was wrong. Is that a violation of the Wisconsin Consumer Act?
Well, Your Honor, at the lower court, and from the very outset, we got into that argument over, was there a violation? And I think, technically speaking, there is no violation, a violation in the sense that it entitles you, or excuse me, the party that obtains the dismissal to any separate statutory penalty, the $25 penalty or otherwise. The only remedy for not filing in a proper venue is dismissal. That is the remedy. Now, the other question is the fee provision kick in addition to
that? That's exactly what I'm getting to. The attorney's fees, apparently, or at least it's arguable that the test requires in the second prong that there's a violation of the Wisconsin Consumer Act. doesn't seem to me that improper venue, unless it's raised by the pleadings as a deceptive practice, improper venue is a violation of the Wisconsin Consumer Act, entitling you to attorney's fees.
Your Honor, it may not be a violation entitling a customer to a statutory penalty, but it is certainly a failure to comply with the venue provision. And in Milwaukee County, Your Honor,
I need help on this, because you're not just asking for dismissal. You got that remedy. So what you're really asking for are attorney's fees.
Correct.
In order to get attorney's fees, as I understand it, you have to show there's a violation of the Wisconsin Consumer Act. Am I wrong on that?
Well, Your Honor, the customers would hope that this court would issue a decision that does not even put a violation requirement in its decision. If a customer succeeds, if a customer obtains dismissal of a lawsuit, that is success.
Then how do you figure in the Bank of DeSoto case that makes reference to the violation of the consumer code as a requirement for attorney's fees, as I recall?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure that case was not fully developed on the facts of whether or not if the court really, truly focused on that issue in this case. There can be situations, Your Honor, where there will be failures to comply, customer will succeed, actions will be dismissed, and they should be entitled to attorney fees to compensate them for that success.
Well, then, as I understand your argument, that in order to get attorney's fees in this case, it's your position that, number one, there may not have been a violation of the Wisconsin Consumer Act, and number two, you don't need a violation of the Wisconsin Consumer Act. Is that your position?
Correct, Your Honor. And violation in the sense that it's going to entitle you to one of the statutory penalties, either the $25 penalty or otherwise. And I don't think that the customers are entitled to that penalty. The remedy that the customers get under the venue statute is dismissal.
Now, the difference between this case and the next case is, in the next case, you are arguing that they violated the act by taking back the cars.
Correct, Your Honor. Took possession.
Right. So that's and you're arguing that they violated the statutes by repossessing under a void judgment.
Correct.
All right. In this case, you're arguing that because you have a dismissal, forget about taking back the cars, because that's not involved in this first case. Because you have a dismissal, you are entitled to attorney fees under 425.308.
Correct,
right?
Your Honor.
Okay. Tell me what you think the elements are for getting attorney fees. And I'm going to ask you that same question, sir. Okay. What are the elements?
Success, Your Honor. And dismissal of a lawsuit filed by a creditor against a customer should equate with success.
Yeah, what's different?
Just a minute. Let's just look at the statute, okay? Statute says if a customer prevails in an action, you say you prevail because he got the default judgment overturned.
Yes, Your Honor.
Arising from a consumer transaction. Is there any question that there's a consumer transaction?
No question at all, Your Honor.
Shall recover the aggregate amount of costs and expenses determined by court to have been reasonably incurred on behalf of a customer's behalf in connection with the prosecution, together with reasonable amount of attorney fees. The problem, and the reason I think Justice Bradley is asking you these questions, is that there are cases that say and an action arising from a consumer transaction means a violation of the statutes. I think that's the point that she's making to you. The point that she's made to me. The question is, if you just read the statute, it says arising from. But
cases seem to say more.
Your Honor, a replevin action, there is no claim that the customer violated the Consumer Act. The claim is that the customer is in default of his obligations under the contract.
You have to show that they, CCP, violated the statute in order to get attorney fees. That's what the cases seem to say. Maybe you disagree with that.
That's how the Court of Appeals wrote the case. On page 8 of their opinion, they said, thus the first prong of our analysis is satisfied, and that the first prong being that they are the prevailing party. The Court of Appeals held, the majority, that the first prong. Then it says, we next address whether the benefit realized by the customers in the trial court resulted from a violation of the WCA. So the Court of Appeals wrote it, that there are two prongs. That's what we're trying. And now you seem to be saying that the Court of Appeals was wrong.
Your Honor, that's why this whole argument occurred in the lower court, is that there was this argument, was there a violation? The customers certainly feel that there was a clear-cut failure to comply with the requirement, the venue requirement, by this creditor in this case. And if that is a violation, and I think that it can be, it is a violation of the Act in that sense, it is a failure to comply with the venue provision, that the only remedy for that violation is dismissal.
But there's been no other, what I think Justice Babbage and others are referring to is that the cases, like the Footville case, the Harville case, say that there has to be some violation, substantive violation of the Wisconsin Consumer Act. Here we're looking at, quote, a procedural situation. That's what venue is. It's starting the procedure, and usually and normally when you have a dismissal of a venue, you simply start it over. Here, what you're asking for is it's a fait complete. In other words, it's over. It's over before it started is what I'm having a little difficulty understanding the argument as far as what you're making. You're saying you don't have to violate the Consumer Act, and yet the Court of Appeals said you had to have that. That was and you're saying no.
That's correct, Your Honor. If the court gets away from the focus on a violation, and if we just have success be the determining factor, a dismissal equating with success, a rule of that nature will do wonders to serve the interests of customers around the state. It'll promote this attorney.
I think if we're doing fairness and equity and saying, all right, that was the intent of the Wisconsin Consumer Act, but I think the cases that have gone before this have said we have to have some tangible violation. And when we talk about whether or not a venue violation is a violation of the Wisconsin Consumer Act, that is what we're looking at. By starting this case, that in itself is the end. The case ends before it starts because of the wrong venue. And that's what you're saying.
Yes, Your Honor. And if the court wishes to stick with this violation concept, and this is a violation in that sense. It was a failure to comply with the venue provision. The creditor selected the venue.
Yeah, but you know when you have and I guess the argument's been brought up, the lack of intention, did they intentionally intend to do it, and that was not apparently fully developed, but when you get away from Milwaukee County and this is going to apply to the whole state, any merchant that is under the Wisconsin Consumer Act who may or may not have an attorney but starts the action, thinks that it's okay, but it isn't. Venue is not correct. And then if this case is meant to say that, then that's it. That's over. They lose because they chose the wrong county. And that's what you want us to say.
Yes, yes, Your Honor. If there's any sort of dismissal of an action,
right,
other than one that's by stipulation between the parties that provides otherwise, the customer should start out the next action at ground zero without an attorney fee bill being carried with them to the next action.
In this case, the customer is always right if you get the wrong venue. That's basically what we would be saying.
Yes, Your Honor. But But if the attorney for the creditor wishes to stand up and dismiss its case on the day of trial, for whatever reason, if he, the weather's nice and he wants to play golf, I mean, the creditor, if the case is voluntarily dismissed, the customer has incurred attorney fees that he should be entitled to compensation for. Dismissal should be the guiding factor.
Yeah, and that's what happened here, actually. They granted the voluntary dismissal of the creditor. That is, I understand, the pleadings. That's what Judge Mullins did.
Yes.
But the issue is whether or not you need a violation. And you're saying, really, you don't, and in any event, that venue has to be treated differently in a Wisconsin Consumer Act transaction.
Precisely, Your Honor.
Could I ask, what is the obligation of the customer when the customer receives the summons?
Your Honor, the customer is supposed to appear in response to a summons. The legislature, however, Your Honor, for consumer credit transactions has said that if a customer does not appear in response to a summons and there is a defect in venue, that the action shall be dismissed. In other words, the customer is protected against default judgments for not having appeared pursuant to summons. And I suppose, Your Honor, if we could ever expect a customer to know the venue provision in advance, he could ignore the summons, saying it's apparent, it's obvious that venue is improper. I do not need to appear and make a conscious decision of that. However, I suggest, Your Honor, that's not the real world. These customers, they don't know the law. And that's why the law is shaped the way it is by the legislature, to protect the consumer, because he can't be expected to know the law like a merchant whose business it is to know the law, follow the law.
Is there a time limit on when the customer can come and challenge the default judgment?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I missed the beginning of your question.
Is there a time limit?
Yes, Your Honor.
Within which, what is that?
Your Honor, a customer has 12 months to seek to reopen and dismiss default judgments, small claims default judgments.
Where is that?
Your Honor, it's in the small claims chapter 799.
It relates to all judgments, not only.
Correct, Your Honor. And, Your Honor, I don't think any competent attorney in good conscience could have let that deadline pass without making motions, irrespective of who's going to get his fees or not under the Act. I mean, in good conscience, they couldn't let that deadline pass. The potential risk to a customer from a future harm from the judgment on the record book, it wouldn't have made good sense. When you can do it in a timely fashion and the law allows you to do so, it has to be done by a careful attorney.
Could I ask you, are you suggesting that the creditor here sort of deliberately misfiled in the wrong county?
Without a doubt, Your Honor. They could. And if they can get it through...
Not that they could, but did they?
In this case, Your Honor? In these cases?
Yeah.
Your Honor, I don't know that has been fully developed at this point. I believe, Your Honor, the most that I could offer to this court is that there was a lack of training by the person, non-lawyer employee, that was assigned to handle these replevin actions, an important task of repossessing people's property, and was just not trained in the law.
Wouldn't that be a good test to have it fall under the Consumer Act if there was a showing at the lower court that this is an intentional and obvious way to get around the venue statute? Wouldn't that be because what kind of bothers me is that you have a good faith filing by a merchant. It makes no difference. You're out right away. And if there isn't any showing of any intention or anything of that nature, then it's sort of a, in my opinion, it's a one-way street when it's not always involving the community credits, involving a lot of other merchants who may do this themselves. And you're saying that they are held to an absolute knowledge of not only the venue statute, but the venue statute is, as someone said, is sort of a floating situation where there are some, it's not entirely always clear, but once, if the court would write this and say you prevail, that venue, the procedure, if it's done wrong, is something that violates the act, then it seems to me that it makes no difference whether it's intentional or otherwise. It just is.
Your Honor, I'd like to make two points, sure, if I could. Number one, it is very easy for a creditor to select a proper venue in 99.999% of the cases where it has to do so. It can always select where the contract was signed. It knows where it was signed. It won't be in error if it does so. The problem is going to be with an out-of-state contract. It's going to know where the customer resides. If, unless the property has been abandoned, the customer doesn't reside in the state, it can then go to the third choice of where the collateral is located. So it is easy for a creditor to select proper venue in the first instance. And secondly, Your Honor, the other factors have been considered. The Wisconsin legislature, I believe, followed the federal legislature's lead on enacting fair venue in consumer credit transactions. And the federal legislation was in response to the Federal Trade Commission study, which found that consumers were suffering default judgments in an abnormal number of cases. Advantage was being taken advantage of them by misfiling, or not by, by filing in disadvantageous places for the consumers. And as a result, they decided, the federal legislation, two locations, where the customer resides or where it's signed. Wisconsin has basically gone to the third of the location where the collateral is at. And it needs to because of the peculiar situation where property has been abandoned in the state and there's no other proper location where they could commence the action.
So the statute doesn't require misrepresentation, ill will, malice, or anything else. It's just a flat-out statute. If you pick the wrong venue, you get dismissed.
That's correct, Your Honor.
It might have been better had they put in intent and malfeasance, et cetera, but they didn't.
Customers don't believe that it has to be shown or that...
Statute doesn't say so.
No, Your Honor.
And no violation of the act has to be shown. That's your position.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, but aren't you? You do
success
have to
without showing a specific violation.
Yeah, but you don't have to go that far, do you, to win on this case?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think there's a failure to comply with the venue provision.
Is a violation of the statute.
And the remedy is dismissal.
Well, but if that's a violation of the statute, look at the summons in this case. I mean, you don't have to look at it now, but suppose the statute 425-205 sets forth what a summons has to say. The summons shall state this. And that statute says the summons shall have, in the lower left-hand corner, the plaintiff's post office address, the plaintiff's attorney, if any, and the defendant's post office address. And let's say the summons utilized in these cases doesn't have that. If you would raise that, I mean, would that give you standing to say, oh, look, this is a violation of the act?
Oh, no, Your Honor. I think that the customer could certainly correct the record at that point in time and establish that the customer does reside in that location, or that, I mean, it is a matter of appearance.
I mean, it's contrary to the act, but it's not a violation of the act.
That's correct, Your Honor. It's not a violation until we reach the point that there is no appearance of venue. I mean, there's a failure to comply. Your Honor, we get into this whole discussion of violation that presents problems. And consumers won't get the remedy of being compensated if they challenge it. If the customer's attorney goes in before the default judgment and objects, and the action is dismissed, and they have to go to another county, the proper county, to file, shouldn't the customer be entitled to start without a debt of an attorney fee caused strictly by a selection of improper venue to begin with? That is the customer's position, that they should.
Mr. Harmon.
Sorry, Your Honor.
No.
That's all right. Justice Bambidge has a question.
Mr. Harmon, I have a sense of...
Your Honor, my red light is off. Or on.
The chief's prerogative allows you to stay up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Maybe you don't want to stay up, but we do. It seems to me like we are sort of passing each other in the night. I look at the DeSoto case, and I look at the Nicolau case, and they both seem to state very clearly that in order for you to get reasonable attorney fees, there must be a violation of the act. It's right in that, in the DeSoto case. If no act violation is found, attorney fees shall not be awarded. End of quote. And yet you seem to be saying, oh, we don't have to concern ourselves with whether it was a violation. All we have to find is that I succeeded. Now, that's, see, are you asking us to overrule DeSoto and overrule Nicolau?
Well, Your Honor, in that case, it might have been a situation was either or, because there was a clear, it would either been a clear violation entitling the customer to a statutory penalty amount or not. And it would have ultimately determined success.
Okay.
In this case, that's not the situation.
Well, see, understand our problem. We're reviewing the Court of Appeals decision. And the Court of Appeals decision said you had to have two prongs. At least that's how they wrote it. Are you saying they wrote it wrong?
I would have wrote it slightly different, Your Honor, but not wrong.
But
it can be rationalized with there was a failure to comply with the venue provision, Your Honor, and that is a violation. And the only remedy is dismissal. There's no penalty, dollar remedy. It's strictly a remedy of dismissal.
Well, and attorney fees under 805 are boring. I mean, I'm just saying that...
Your Honor, that it is mentioned in the record they were attorney fees at times, motion costs, I think, in one of the cases. But, Your Honor, the attorney fee issue arose in the first case before the first hearing. In the Mader case, and it's reflected in the record, there was a telephone conference between the counsel for the customers and counsel for community credit. About a month after the first action was filed in advance of the first hearing, the first three cases had actually been filed at that point in time. Stipulation was prepared and submitted to Counsel for Community Credit. It provided for reopening and dismissal of the actions plus reasonable attorney fees. It was refused, as the arguments in the Mader case reflect, and here we are. All the cases that followed could have been handled with a simple stip and order of dismissal without even a necessary motion if the position wouldn't have been, the issue wouldn't have been raised at that point. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. So what do you think the elements are, sir?
As far as this last point the counsel just made, I'd like to point out that the stipulation went to a lawyer that was not retained by Community Credit to defend them in this action. It was a different law firm. It was not my law firm, and that lawyer had no authority to deal with the stipulation. I'd like to just get back to one thing. In the briefs, the customers make a very stunning concession, and I'm going to quote from the customers' briefs. A creditor's failure to comply with the venue provisions does not...